Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Welcome to Unbelievable for another classic replay from the archives. I'm Ruth Jackson, and in today's episode, we hear from J. Warner Wallace, a homicide detective specialising in cold case murder investigations. In his book, Cold Case Christianity, he shows how the same tools of investigating evidence can show that the Gospels are trustworthy accounts. Jim tells how the evidence moved him from atheism to Christianity, and he debates with two sceptical callers about differing timelines in the Gospels and corroboration. So, let's see how they get on.
A really exciting show for you today as we look at the detective and the Gospels, asking, is there enough evidence to make the case for Christianity? My guest today is J. Warner Wallace. He's a homicide detective from California, and his new book, Cold Case Christianity, shows how you can use the same techniques of assessing evidence that he has used in his career to investigate cold case Christianity, whether the Gospels and what they say about Jesus can be believed. And we're going to be having J. Warner Wallace, Jim, to give him his short name, in conversation with a couple of skeptics today who are going to be joining us by phone as we look at whether we can trust the timeline of Jesus' ministry across the four Gospels, and also whether there's enough evidence beyond the Gospels to make its testimony reliable. So really looking at the evidence for the Gospels through the eyes of a homicide detective who joins me now. Thank you very much for joining me on the program today, Jim.
Oh, I'm honored to be on the program with you, Justin. I appreciate you having me.
Well, I'm really pleased you're able to make the time. You've got a fascinating story. You were an atheist and you became a Christian relatively late on, I think in your mid-30s. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to Christianity?
Yeah, I mean, most of what I write about in Cold Case Christianity is in some ways just a kind of a recollection of the process that I went through to come to faith. I mean, I was somebody who had a very high regard for evidence. This is something I did in my career. But as a young man, didn't really have anybody in my life who was a Christian model. I wasn't raised in the church, and my dad is still a non-believer. He also was a detective. He's worked at the same agency that I work at, and now my son is also working there. So we're three generations of cops, and I would probably could describe myself as, well, my dad always described me as an angry atheist. I never really thought of myself as being all that angry, but I did get impatient with fellow officers who were Christians, who, when you asked them questions and kind of pushed back on some of these issues, really did not have good explanations, good evidential explanations anyway, for why they believed what they believed. That did irritate me, and I probably was a little bit impatient with some of that. But I first got interested, Justin, in my 30s, about 35. Just really interested more in the teaching of Jesus as a wise sage, the same way you might be interested in any other ancient sage. And that's what started my investigation of just the red letters. I would have rejected anything outside just the teaching of Jesus. I just wanted to see what did he have to say, just as a kind of a simple inquiry into history. But it started me down a path in which I started to evaluate the Gospels, because to get to those red letters, I had to sift through the Gospels.
So tell us a little bit about how that all played into the way you assessed evidence as a detective, because it sounds to me like you're a kind of very rational-minded person, Jim, and it sounds to me like you sort of had a kind of methodology in your career that you tend to try and apply to other areas of your life too.
Yes, that's probably true. I mean, I think somebody recently said to me, gosh, you have to make a case for everything, don't you? And that's probably true. And that can be a bit irritating for some people. But for me, a lot of it was coming through a process where I was working first. I worked gang details for a couple of years, and then I worked in undercover for 4 years, and I started working robbery homicide, and then eventually got involved in working just cold case homicides. These are unsolved homicides. There's no statute of limitations. So we're looking at cases that are from the past. My cases generally run from about 1979 to about 1984. And so as I started to work through the evidence in these cases, I realized there were some tools that you start to develop. Now, I didn't really have an interest in the Gospels or interest in Christianity, but those tools, I do think, have some application, albeit maybe limited, but I think there is some important application that we can use those tools when examining the claims of the... Think about it this way. Cold cases are an event in the distant past for which I have no living eyewitness. There was no witness at the time who even could say, I saw this suspect do it. That's why it's still cold. And also, I don't have forensic evidence usually. Usually my cases are not built on DNA or fingerprints. I have cases that I've built time and time again on nothing other than circumstantial evidence that we assembled in a cumulative way to make a case about an event in the distant past. And so I think that that skill set is similar to what we do in making a case about what happened in the distant past related to Jesus. And so I've just tried to kind of apply that skill set going forward.
Well, we'll go into a bit more detail later on in the show about the way you lay that out in the book. It's absolutely fascinating the way you sort of relate the ways you assess the evidence in a crime case to the way you could assess the evidence for the reliability of the Gospels. And we'll come to more of that later, but I'd really like to just hear kind of what was it that eventually tipped the balance for you to enable you to accept Christ, which is a kind of a major, if you like, mental shift that goes a little bit beyond just kind of saying the evidence has convinced me, perhaps. Would you say?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think for me, I certainly did not initiate the investigation or initiate my study of Jesus's words with the goal in mind. You know, I didn't come in and say, hey, I really need to get my life together and I've got some things that are broken here or there. I actually had a great life as a non-believer. I felt like I had everything I could ever want. I wasn't trying to fix something. I just, as I read through this account, that the weight of the cumulative case became powerful for me. And so I started to say, okay, if I was to be very systematic about this and evaluate these claims of these gospel writers as though they were truly eyewitnesses, let's just take a step in that direction, I would use a template, the same template I would use with any eyewitness to see if they're reliable in front of a jury. And so if I applied that template, it started to reveal things to me. And I gotta tell you, if not, my biggest problem, Justin, was that the existence of the supernatural in the accounts. I mean, if there was no claims of miracles, walking on water, healing, the resurrection, if these were not in the Gospels, I doubt that anyone would look at the evidence we have and say we don't know enough about Jesus. It's unreliable. This is not historically reliable. I think what causes people to kind of begin the assessment that this is not historically reliable is the fact that it includes elements that I would have said have to be mythological. They cannot be. I rejected the supernatural altogether. So the minute I encountered it in the Gospels, I would just scratch that part out. That can't be true. And so as I went through this, I realized that, wow, you know, if you just were to scratch those elements out, a process you would take to assess the reliability of these witnesses, I think you'd come away thinking, hey, these are reliable. The problem, though, was just that I really had a presupposition that if I just laid that presupposition down for a minute, it gave me a very different view into the Gospels. So I think you're right in the sense that there wasn't, I can tell you, people always ask me, well, what was your day of delivery or your, you know, the moment? I didn't have that kind of a moment. It was a process of time in which I eventually examined, and I had a number of objections that I had to overcome. And as I overcame those objections, I had to ask myself then, okay, Jim, is this really a matter of there not being enough evidence? Or is this really a matter of you not wanting there to be enough evidence? And I got to that question, then I had to really assess my own presuppositions and my own desire, really, in this, you know. So I think there probably was a time in which I had to assess that, but it wasn't as though I had this moment where I said, okay, I'm saved, you know. I mean, it was really a process for me.
You're listening to Unbelievable this afternoon, talking to J. Warner Wallace, the author of Cold Case Christianity. He shows in it how the same techniques of assessing evidence that he used to investigate cold case homicides can be used to find out whether the Gospels and what they say about Jesus can be believed.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, let's say hello to Rob in the Netherlands at this point, who's been waiting patiently on the line. Thank you very much, Rob, for joining us today. Rob, just to make the most of the time, I won't go in too much into your background, but you would describe yourself as an atheist, would you?
Yes, I do. Hi, Justin, and hi, Jim. First of all, what a coincidence that I have an ex-cop on the other side of the debate. I'm an ex-cop as well. I used to be a detective at the forensics department in Suriname, South America, between 86 and 90. So I know where he's coming from. It's a very nice...
We're talking about whether there's enough evidence to make the case for Christianity, drawing on Jim's experience as a homicide detective and the techniques he used to assess the evidence. Now, you haven't read the book, but that's fine, because we can just go from where you are with your concerns, your objections to the Gospels. Do you want to just sketch out what your main question is, and then we'll let Jim respond and you guys have a conversation on that?
Yes. The bottom line is that I have a hard time to reconcile all the historical items in the Gospels with secular history. So I have a couple of items that are mentioned in the Gospels. The first is, of course, the birth narratives in Matthew and Luke, where Matthew clearly places the birth during the reign of Herod the Great, and Luke puts the birth during the governorship of Governor Quirinius of Syria. And those didn't overlap. That's the first part. Second part is that Luke states in Luke 3:1, I think, that Jesus started his ministry when he was around 30 years old. That's one part. And Jesus, according to both Matthew and Mark, started his ministry after John the Baptist was arrested. John the Baptist was arrested because of an issue with Herod Antipas wanting to marry the wife of his former brother named Herodias. And that happened in the early 30s. So if Jesus was arrested after John the Baptist's arrest, he was way older than 30 at that time. John also mentions the moment that Jesus started his ministry with the issue of overthrowing the tables of the money changers in the temple. And someone misunderstood him and said, we've been building this temple for 46 years, and you want to rebuild it in 3 days. And John explains that misunderstanding. But John seems to support Matthew in this regard, because if the temple was started to be built at 20 BCE, that means that the issue of the overthrowing of the money changers should happen around 27. So Jesus might have been 31 by then.
Okay.
But that is a minimum time.
Mm.
That is also short of John the Baptist starting his ministry at 29 CE, which is in the 15th year of Caesar Tiberius. So how do you reconcile Jesus being born during the reign of Herod the Great, who died in 4 BCE, and so he must have been born before that, with the fact that John the Baptist only started his ministry in 29 CE, so Jesus was way over 30 by then.
Right. Well, there's a heck of a lot there to back in there,
yeah, it
Rob. It's a lot of kind of intertwining sort of dates and stories across the Gospels, yeah. and whether we can harmonize or find a way in which that can work out. So maybe worth starting with the birth narratives, I have a feeling here, Jim.
Okay.
Do you want to have a crack at this and see if you can sort of make any sense of the way these timelines interact?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm like you, I know there's a lot that's been presented here, so I'm trying to figure out the best way, Rob, to kind of respond in the time we have related to these issues. I think they're all important issues, and I my sense of it is that typically when people come to these issues, it's because they are concerned. For example, with Quirinius, this idea is that, hey, whoever wrote this apparently is somebody who's unfamiliar with the real history of what happened. And so therefore, the argument, I think, usually, and this is what the position I would have taken, is that this is a late account. This has got to be later. And because I used to, for example, point to the history, say, for example, that Josephus offers and say, well, look, it doesn't seem like it doesn't line up, and especially this Quirinius issue. Now, let me just offer a couple of thoughts in the micro related to Quirinius, and then a couple of larger thoughts in the macro related to how I approach investigations of this nature. Related to Quirinius, there's lots of folks who have offered a view, starting with Tertullian in the 3rd century, but some scholars, and I'm familiar with kind of the typical Christian apologist response here, some scholars will say, hey, you know, there's some recent archaeological discoveries that seem to reveal that we have a couple of Quiriniuses in play. For example, there's a Quirinius that's mentioned in John McRae's book called Archaeology in the New Testament that was first examined by a guy named Jerry Vardaman. So maybe a coin, or there's also a base of a statue that has been erected in a city in Antioch that relates to Quirinius. Some scholars, like Tertullian, think that there's a second term, perhaps that Quirinius was working under Governor Saturninus. And so you've got one reign in which he's procurator under that governor, in which he may assume his title, and then another reign in which he's governor himself. So, I mean, these are offers that people have made in over time on this issue. But from my perspective, as a guy who was looking at it as a detective, and you may relate this, as you have some similar experiences, it sounds like, I first of all looked at it and said, hey, look, the first thing I'm concerned about with any eyewitness is this template that I use to determine eyewitness reliability. And the very first step is, you say you saw this, or you're aware of this in a firsthand way, or you were present at the time. Were you really there? Because lots of witnesses will say they are involved in a case when all they want is the glamour of the case. So the first question, were they really present? That's a huge issue for me. And it's really the issue that I think drives these questions about the historical lining up of facts in the Gospels and in secular history. By the way, it's interesting to me that many of my skeptical friends will argue that, hey, Luke seems to be saying something different than Josephus, for example. That's why you can't trust Luke. Others will say, in fact, no, actually, Luke is writing this very late and relying on Josephus as his guide. So I can't have it both ways. Now, I would say that as I examined the first question, is the witness really present? I have to make a case, I think, in this for the early dating of Luke. How early does Luke's gospel appear? If I've got good reason to believe a witness was really there as they said they were, then I have to understand, well, why is it that this doesn't seem to jive? And I can tell you that's always the case in my witness accounts. Very seldom do any witnesses ever agree on anything. But the first question I have is, were you really there? So I think that one of the things I tried to do in the book is take the time to make the case based on the absence of detail in Acts, the absence of the detail related to the temple destruction or the siege of Jerusalem, or the absence of any mention of the death of James, Peter, or Paul, when you've included minor characters like Stephen and James, the brother of John. These characters are mentioned. I think also there's some internal evidence in the scriptures that allow us to date the Gospel of Luke early enough. And if we think we've got enough information about history today to see a discrepancy, it seems to me that somebody writing this gospel as early as it was written, even if you reject that it was Luke, ought to have had access to the same information. So that's why I have to take another step and say, well, what is it that's causing this apparent discrepancy? As a general rule, I take this approach. If I'm convinced that the witness was actually there when they said they were there. And so I think that I would assume that whoever wrote this early in history would have recognized these apparent contradictions. For example, when you look at the first level of officers in the chain of custody, you've got the writers of Scripture, and then you have their immediate students. So, for example, Polycarp, Ignatius, and Papias are the students of John, and they all write about the Gospel of John and the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke. They actually refer to all these Gospels, and they present a view of Jesus in the very early 2nd century, 110 or so AD, that is unified and is unquestioning about these details, and they seem to be very, very close. So if you rejected the dating of the Gospels themselves, you have people who were very early in history who seem to be able to harmonize these events without any problem. And so I'm wondering, why did they not have a problem and we do?
Just to kind of summarize then what you're saying there, you think there's good evidence that, that the Gospel of Luke was written pretty early on in terms of the events that it's recording, and that they would have been far more in the position to make sure the events harmonized, if you like, and were corresponded to the correct dates than we are, in a sense. And the fact that presumably Luke is pretty good on other aspects of the historical facts of the time, you're prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt in that sense as a witness that we're probably just missing something that on our level it looks like, oh, that date with Quirinius is out. Well, there probably is a pretty good explanation given his reliability as a witness generally.
Well, let me just throw this one last thing in, Rob, then I'll let you respond to this. I mean, I think what you discover in courtrooms all the time is we as Christians hold this document. We say, well, the original documents are inerrant. I mean, and what's been transmitted over time to us is now reliable. We can return with reliability to the original content. That's what our claims are. But as a detective, my expectations are far lower than that. I've never had a witness in a criminal trial who was inerrant. Yet these same witnesses are always deemed reliable. In fact, witnesses on a stand can be incorrect about something, can be in error about something. And as long as the juror understands what it is that would cause them to see this slightly differently, they can still accept their testimony as reliable. We actually have a jury instruction in California from judges to jurors on this issue. So I took the same approach as a skeptic coming into the Gospels, that I sense that there's something going on here. I see this all the time when I have a case where I've got two IOs, investigating officers, who are writing reports about something 30 years ago, and now I have no access to those IOs and no access to their witnesses, and there appears to be a contradiction, but there wasn't a contradiction to them back 30 years ago. They wrote this and put this in their reports without it blinking. So I've got to think deeply about what is it that I'm not seeing that they clearly saw.
Well, let's give Rob a chance to respond. And Rob, time is against us, as always, on this show. And we're kind of really still at this point of looking at this birth narrative and this dating of Quirinius. What do you make generally of Jim's case there, that we need to probably give the benefit of the doubt in this case to an early witness seeing something that we perhaps haven't got access to now?
To be frank, the only thing I heard in Jim's response were a possible earlier function of Quirinius in Syria, and for the rest, he talked about the reliability of the early stage when Luke wrote his gospel, but he didn't really react to the points I was making. Let me go very shortly into the Quirinius issue. It might be that he was second in command in Syria during one of the earlier governors like Saturninus. What's a fact is that since he became consul in 12 BCE until after the death of Herod, he was not governor. That's a fact. Second fact is that there was a census in 6 CE under Quirinius because Archelaus was deposed and the spoils had to be investigated. So there was a census. Josephus wrote about it, and there was a revolt led by Judas of Galilee, which is mentioned both by Josephus and in Acts 5:37. So we know that the census happened then. It's very unlikely that an earlier census happened, because by that time, whole of Israel, named Judea by that time, but whole of Israel was a tributary. Rome didn't hold censuses in tributaries. They just paid a standard amount of money to Rome. So there is no case for an earlier census in that area that would force Joseph and Maria to go to Bethlehem.
Okay.
Well, that's about.
Yeah. Well, let's just allow Jim a chance to respond, and hopefully then perhaps we'll take a quick break and we'll try and just wrap up a bit more about the general issue of timelines across the gospel. Yeah. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I think that some good points are being made about Quirinius, but you'll notice that a lot of we make a lot of claims about what is true about history. And you did this yourself, Rob, as you make claims about, well, there's no way another census could be taken. This is not reasonable. And I understand your position on that. All of us look at the events of the past and we try to determine what is the most reasonable course of events. I think, though, that as I look at this, that to say it's not reasonable that they would have taken more than one census. It's not reasonable that Quirinius may have used the title of governor as he's working for a governor. It's not reasonable. These are assumptions we make about history that are based on the writings of other ancient authors, and that's fine. My only observation here is my experience in working these cases, and probably yours too, is that the folks who are investigating the case early actually have better access to the information than we do. So I'm interested in seeing what do the earliest people say related to the reliability of Luke's gospel. Is this an issue for them? And if it's not an issue for them, then we have one of two things. Number one, perhaps the copy we have in our hands has somehow been altered from what they had in their hands. That's always a possibility. Or that they have some information that we don't have access to that removes it as a question. And that's something I have to assess in every one of my cold cases as well. And I think that's why I think that to return to overarching principles. So let's just go the worst case scenario. Let's just go completely the worst case scenario for us as Christians. This information that Luke is offering us is inaccurate, or the information we have in our present day text that we're talking about today, that we're examining, has been changed. It's inaccurate. It's no longer what it was in the original. My question is this the kind of thing that in a typical trial I would have involving a witness, that if I could ascertain for sure they were actually present at the time, would disqualify their reliability? Could they be wrong about this yet still be reliable? And I'm not speaking as a Christian now. I'm speaking as an atheist detective. Would I be willing to accept an error here, yet other things they say are completely accurate? Especially when, over and over again, Luke, Rob, we'd have to say that Luke does get a lot about history right. Not only does he get a lot about history right, we've got other witnesses, the other Gospels, in which they are in agreement. So typically we'll say, gosh, I see a point of disagreement. One of these gospel authors doesn't agree with the other three. And we ignore the fact the other three agree with each other. So I think we have to look at this and say, hey, is this the kind of thing that I would use to disqualify this account altogether? And that's why I say, if you were to remove the supernatural elements from the Gospels and historians were assessing them, even a Bart Ehrman who assesses them, even though he thinks that's a mythological element, assesses them as reliable related to the existence and life of Jesus.
We're going to have to take a quick break, I'm afraid, gentlemen. We've spent some time looking at this issue of the birth narrative, the dating of the census by Quirinius that Luke mentions and so on. And still some stuff we should probably get to in terms of Rob's more general question about whether other sort of timelines in the gospel match up. And whether this is a problem for the reliability of the gospels. Jim Warner Wallace is with me, J. Warner Wallace, author of Cold Case Christianity, bringing his expertise as a homicide detective to the issue of whether we can trust the evidence for the gospels today. So we're going to carry on in just a moment's time here on the show. We'll let Rob come back as well. So keep listening. This is Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, back in a moment. Fascinating show today as I'm joined by...
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital, we want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith and the Evidence for God Apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Unbelievable show. Thank you for your support.
Homicide detective J. Warner Wallace, author of the book Cold Case Christianity, Jim is out in the States. He's in California, part of the Stand to Reason team as well. But he's for years investigated cold case homicides, and he's taken those same skills, ways of assessing the evidence, and put them on the case for Christianity. It was something that led him to faith in Christ from atheism. And today, Jim is being grilled by a couple of unbelievable listeners who are skeptics, who aren't convinced they can trust the Gospels. And we've had Rob on the line today already, talking about whether the birth narratives and the dating of those make sense. And what we haven't managed to get to so much is the more general issue of the timeline. So we'll come back to Jim in a moment's time to find out a little bit more about the book and the way he's laid it out and some of the stories, fascinating stories about detective work and criminal cases that sort of he brings to bear in illustrating some of the issues about the reliability of the Gospels. But right now, Rob in the Netherlands is with us. Thank you, Rob, for continuing to stay on the line on the show today. Not much time, but just would you briefly spell out what your general concerns are in terms of how the different Gospels kind of for you don't match up in terms of the way the timelines appear for various acts and individuals within them?
Okay. Jim assumed that I doubt accuracy of Luke. To be honest, I doubt the accuracy of Matthew. Let's assume that Jesus indeed was born before the death of Herod in 4 BCE. Okay? John the Baptist began his ministry in 29 CE. That is the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius. He must have had a couple of years to attract all people of all over Judea to come and be baptized by him. And there was this issue where the former wife of Herod Antipas, who heard that he had a relationship with Herodias, went to his father, Aretas, and that whole thing started a war between Herod Antipas and King Aretas of Nabatea. And Herod lost that war. That all happened in the early 30s. And because of that, John the Baptist was arrested. So somewhere in the early 30s, he was arrested. And after that, Jesus began his ministry. So if Jesus began his ministry in the early 30s, and he was born in 4 BCE, he was close to 35 when he began his ministry. That's not really around 30 years, as Luke says in
Okay, so you've outlined the problem quite well there, on whether the historical things we know about when John's beheading would likely have taken place in the context of Herod Antipas and what he was doing and so on seems to make Jesus older at the point of entering ministry than Luke says he was. Okay, just any brief response to this so that we can have a bit of a to and fro between you and Rob, Jim.
Yeah, and I think that you could probably, Rob, we could probably find a number of these issues. For example, I've heard also pushback on whether or not does Jesus spend 40 days after the baptism. It seems that one narrative suggests that he does. Another narrative seems to suggest that he doesn't. There's a certain issue related to whether or not the overturning you mentioned earlier, the overturning of the tables in the temple, how does this relate in terms of the dating of when the temple construction began? Of course, that's usually scholars are going to differ on how they date those number of years. What are they really talking about in terms of the beginning of the construction? Lots of issues like this are raised, and I see these raised a lot. I have a couple of general overarching principles I'll throw out to you for consideration that I used as I assessed these. The first thing I noticed right away is that, unfortunately, the Gospels don't assess narratives the same way that you and I might assess a historical narrative today. You often see that the authors of Gospels are going to organize materials in a way that's not necessarily chronological. In fact, Papias says that Mark was not being careful about chronology in the first century when he talks about Papias in his writing. Talks about Mark, rather, in his writing of Peter's narrative. So you've got then, of course, in the first chapter of Luke says, I'm going to come in and put this in order for you, Theophilus. He actually calls it an orderly account, which I think is interesting. He's trying to put this in some kind of order. So I think that the question we really have when it comes down to looking at and comparing what the narratives say, I have to assess the nature of eyewitnesses in general. And here's what I see all the time. Okay. I never see eyewitnesses who agree. If I've got four or five for the same case, their statements are always perspectival in some nature. They're always personal in some nature. They always contain some areas of complete agreement, even though there may be areas of differences. And later witnesses are often just trying to fill in gaps for prior witnesses if, in fact, they know what the first witness told me. So I see this kind of same thing happening in Scripture as well. Now, when it comes to the specific issue you're relating here, related to whether or not the dating of Herod's rule or the relationship to Herod Antipas is correct, and how old Jesus was, I assume you assume that there's a discrepancy of years here, a significant discrepancy of how old Jesus really was in this that ought to disqualify all of Scripture. Is that your position?
No, I didn't say that at all. I'm not talking about the general reliability of Scripture. I'm just talking about when did certain key events happen and how reliable are those key events in the Gospels. You look at that Jesus was around 30, and if he was born during Herod the Great, he couldn't have been. That's my issue.
For me, as I'm assessing this case originally, okay, and I'm not as a Christian now, as a skeptic assessing the case, after having done these kinds of cold cases, my issue is, what is it that makes a reliable witness? Does the reliable witness, do I give him any margin for error at all? And I don't really think that's an issue here with the Gospels anyway. I agree with the biblical stand of inerrancy. But I do recognize that over time, the Gospels we have today do have modifications in them from scribal transmission. So my argument is that do we have a way, the same way we would assess a criminal case, to return to the reliable eyewitness account, even though we may have a document in front of us that possesses some degree of variation? And is that degree of variation a disqualifying degree? When is enough enough? Now, when you build, here's what I think, we've got good reason to believe that these Gospels are written early, both internal evidence and external evidence. And if this is the case, then this is what I think does a lot for us as Christians. This idea that are they present does a lot for us as we assess the eyewitnesses. Because it means that this concern that we have today ought to have been a concern for the first readers of the account. And so instead of being an enabler, it should have been an inhibitor to belief in the first century. And this is what I'm looking for. I'm looking for, is this a late edition that therefore was not being proposed to the first readers? Or is this an account that we think is not only early in history, but it hasn't changed? And I made a case in the book also in a whole other chapter about whether or not, and that's the second template element I have. First, are they present? Two, can they be corroborated? Three, have they been accurate or changed their story over time? And four, are they biased? Those are the things we use to assess eyewitnesses. And as I assess this account, I've got to ask, one, is it early? And then two, has it changed over time? And that's done through what I call the chain of custody. You probably are familiar with that. And we're looking at evidence to see if it's changed between the crime and the courtroom. The same thing happens here. Has this document changed from the time it was first written to our reading today? I think there's good evidence to believe those two things have been resolved. They are written early and they haven't changed. So the question is, if they're written early and they haven't changed, the problems we're seeing today, because we think we know enough about history to see a problem, those folks who were even closer to the history didn't see the problem. So I've got to ask myself, where am I missing it?
It's a kind of a similar response in that sense to the issue of the Quirinius dates and so on. Rob, just before we have to drop you and move on, any quick thoughts in response there to Jim?
I think he's selling the historical corollaries short. I know that witnesses are inherently unreliable. I've been an investigator myself. I know that. But if there is something where they tie it to, for instance, the reign of Herod the Great, or the issue of the war with Aretas, that's very tangible. That's something that fixes the timeline. Just saying, hey, well, we don't know the reliability of witnesses, I think it's selling it short.
Okay. Well, thank you, Rob. Really glad that you're able to make the time today and to connect with Jim on the line today. Jim, just before we move to our next caller, you've made the point a few times now about the fact that there's this larger issue of the reliability of the witnesses generally, and that in the end, of course, in your experience as a cop, you will get differences on specifics and so on, but that doesn't necessarily call into question the reliability of the witness generally. Just explain how you're relating that to these sorts of specifics that, that Rob's been bringing up here.
Well, I think, first of all the, every specific that Rob brings up, some Christian apologist has spent time kind of working through that. And I want to take a step before that. That's, it's not as though there aren't a number of kind of historical responses to these kinds of objections. And those are all well and good. But as a non-believer, I would have rejected all those anyway because they're out of the mouths of Christians. I'm looking really more at the bigger issues of reliability. I am not saying that witnesses are notoriously unreliable because that's not the case. If that was the case, I could never adjudicate, never prosecute a single case. Witnesses just have to be deemed reliable through a process. I never assume they are reliable. I discover they're reliable or they aren't through a template. And this is the same template I'm trying to offer in the book, is to say, hey, I would not assume that what the Gospels are saying is accurate. Instead, run them through their paces. But the paces you run witnesses through involve these four steps. And so we have to kind of go through these four steps with them. And this is the other issue, of course, is that all of us are relying upon the testimony of someone to determine what we think is true about the past. So when we find somebody is relying on the testimony of another ancient source to contradict this particular ancient source, this is, you see the battle here. The battle here is about, do we understand, how do we determine which of these sources is reliable? What is the process we use to determine that? And that's where I think that the skill set we use in court may be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating number of chapters. I'll just read some of the titles of them. Learn how to infer, think circumstantially, test your witness, hang on every word, separate artifacts from evidence, resist conspiracy theories. One in chapter 8, and you've already mentioned this, is respect the chain of custody. Do you want, just very briefly before we go to our next caller, to talk a little bit about that and what you take from the criminal cases sort of scenario and how that applies to the gospel scenario as far as this idea of a chain of custody is concerned?
Yeah, very, very quickly. I mean, typically I would have believed as a skeptic that this, if there's, even if these were written early, they've got to have been changed over the years because there's no way these miraculous things happen and no way someone wrote about these when people who were still alive could have said, hey, time out, that didn't happen, I was there. So either they've got to be late accounts, so everyone's dead, or there are accounts that changed over time. And we assess change over time through a chain of custody in criminal cases. If there's a casing at a crime scene and we wonder, did that bullet casing, was it really there? Was that nick in the bullet casing really a present and get it in a trial 30 years later? How do I know if it was really there and it was really in that condition? Well, we look and we say, does someone take a picture of it at the crime scene? Does someone then pass it off to another officer who took another Polaroid, who gave it to a criminalist at the crime lab, who took a 35-millimeter photograph, it gave it back to another detective, it took another Polaroid, and now he brings it into the courtroom. I've now got a chain of custody in both in descriptions and in photographs of that casing all the way from the crime scene to the courtroom. Same thing happens here, I think, in history with the Gospels. We've got a writer of the Gospel making claims, John. He then has somebody he passes the evidence to, who takes another snapshot of Jesus. The snapshot taken next is taken by Ignatius, Polycarp, and Papias. Although we've lost the writing of Papias, we can assess what Ignatius and Polycarp say about Jesus. They're the first people in the chain of custody. Do they describe Jesus in the same way that John does? And they pass it to the next guy, Irenaeus, and he passes it to the next guy, Hippolytus. You keep on doing this down through history, and you can do this and see what the snapshot of Jesus looks like. Is he changing over time from a simple teacher with good ideas to this guy who walked on water and rose from the dead? And what you discover is, from the very earliest officers in the chain of custody, Papias, Ignatius, Clement, they describe Jesus with all the attributes that we know today. Then I've got to, once I know that and I understand that template, I've got to go back and look at every little apparent contradiction and assess it through that lens. And that's a fair lens to assess it in the sense that once I've established the early dating.
Fascinating stuff. We're going to come back in just a moment's time and have another caller. It's going to be Leyland in Canada. As he asks, is there enough evidence beyond the Gospels to make its testimony reliable? You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. My special guest today is J. Warner Wallace, author of Cold Case Christianity. You want to find out more about him? Why not go to the webpage of Unbelievable, where you can find links. That's at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, it's a pleasure to have now Leland, who's coming in from Canada, on the line as we go to our next question to Jim, our cold case detective from California. Leland, thank you for being with me. I know you've been listening to the show for a little while, haven't you?
Yes, I have been, yeah, for a few years now.
Yeah, it's great stuff. Do you want to just give us a brief idea of your background? Are you an atheist, essentially? Was that the way you'd describe yourself?
Essentially, yeah. I'm an atheist. I come from, actually, my family has sort of been a-religious growing up, so I didn't grow up going to a church or anything like that, although I did have friends who went to church. And so, yeah, I was sort of left to my own devices to sort of build a worldview from scratch.
That worldview, obviously, has not brought you to Christianity, but you're obviously interested, and I'm so glad that you've take the opportunity to listen via the podcast, and I know we've been in touch one way or another on Twitter and Facebook and email over the years.
Sure.
Do you want to just lay out your question, though, for Jim today, and then we'll have some time for back and forth as he answers it?
Well, essentially it's, is there enough evidence beyond the Gospels to make the testimony of the Gospels reliable? Because otherwise it's essentially a circular argument, right?
That's a really interesting case. I mean, I don't know, Jim, whether this corresponds to the chapter in the book called Were They Corroborated? Would that be a sort of general area of evidential technique?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a very fair statement that he's and a very fair concern. And it's a concern that really was one of my primary concerns as somebody looking at the Gospels from the outside in, is that I wanted to know, this is the second level we talk about, are they there to begin with? Were they really present? Secondly, can they be verified or corroborated in some way? Third, have they changed their story over time? And fourth, are they biased? So there's a little bit about bias, I think, here, and a little bit about corroboration that needs to be talked about. And I don't want to take up all the time here, but Leland, let me just tell you how I approached it. One thing I learned early on when talking about corroborative evidence is that all corroborative evidence is what I call touch point evidence. Here's what I mean. If a witness says, yeah, I saw this guy go in the bank, he got up on the counter, put his left hand on the counter and took out with his right hand a pistol and pointed at the clerk and said, give me all your money, then I would want to corroborate that statement somehow. And one way I might corroborate that is to go back after the fact and look and see, on that counter where she said he put his left hand, do I have a palm print in the direction it ought to be in order to corroborate what she said? And if I find there's a palm print, I would consider that. And if I brought it into a court of law, we would consider that to be corroborative evidence. But interestingly, you'll note that the presence of the palm print tells us nothing about whether or not the suspect had a gun, nothing about what he said. As a matter of fact, it gives us a very small touch point related to the entire eyewitness statement. And this is always the nature of corroborative evidence, short of, I do occasionally have videotape on or video, digital video on some of these cases, but not very often. So I've got to corroborate on what I call touch point evidence. So when looking at this larger narrative in the scriptures, I got to remember, although I have a very high regard for corroborative evidence, I also have a low expectation for what percentage of the total narrative I'm going to be able to corroborate. And so this is what I see happening when I look at the Gospels. I think there is a significant amount of corroboration outside, but every piece, of course, gets challenged by some skeptic who doesn't want to embrace the writings of Tacitus or Thallus or Marbar Serapion or, Phlegon, whoever it is you may bring up, whatever ancient witness you might bring from outside who has something to say about Jesus. I typically would have found some way to wiggle out of that statement. But what's interesting about making this corroborative effort is that it's substantive. In other words, there's a lot of stuff outside of Scripture, and even inside of Scripture, when the authors describe something accurately, like Luke's accurate description of some of the rules of government that he describes in Acts, for example. Norm Geisler's done a lot of work just on that one area. Or the inclusion of minor villages, minor cities in the Gospels that you don't see ever included in the non-canonical Gospels. The later forgeries are lucky if they include the cities they know, like Jerusalem, but they're unfamiliar largely with the minor cities that are mentioned in the Gospels. I mean, there are reasons both internally and externally. And let me just leave you with one last thought on that before you respond. And that's that typically when I get into a trial and I build a circumstantial case against a defendant, what ends up happening is a number of evidences exist that point and are most reasonably inferred as pointing to the suspect as guilty. And you could argue, man, this guy's just really either incredibly unlucky that there are dozens of pieces of evidence that just coincidentally make him appear to be guilty, or he's just guilty. And this is why he is the one unifying element in all these evidences. And I think in a similar way, the Christian narrative is either incredibly lucky because there happen to be a ton of these touch point corroborations, both from outside sources and also in different lines of investigation, both internally and externally, and they just happen to make the story look like it's true, or they're just unified by the fact the story is true. So I think this is kind of the same approach I take when I look at the nature of corroborative evidence.
Leland, what's your main concern here? Is it that there simply isn't enough corroborative evidence outside sources apart from the Gospels to make us trust the Gospels? And do you want to just give us a little bit of background on that?
Yeah, well, that's basically, you know, foundationally, yeah, that's where I come from. I would like to respond to a couple of points.
Sure, go ahead.
One, in your bank robber example, the real benefit that we have is that you could, in that situation, go into the bank and look for an actual physical palm print. So your proximity in time to the event allows you to do that sort of thing. Many of the Gospels, I think most scholars believe or will agree with, many of the Gospels were written decades after the fact. And so that separation in time sort of takes you away from being able to say, well, this definitely happened, because you don't have that immediate access to the evidence. Another thing you point out is the existence of minutiae, like the names of towns and things like that. And the problem I have with that is, I mean, you could look at things like Spider-Man comic books or Harry Potter that both are set in ostensibly real locations. But if I go to New York, I'm not going to be looking out for, you know, a guy walking on the walls who can lift cars. So, I mean, there, you know, those are some valid points. Just one other thing I'd like to allude to is, in a recent paper by Stephen Law, he mentioned something called a contamination principle, which essentially is when a testimony or a document has a narrative that combines both mundane claims and a significant proportion of extraordinary claims. There's a very good reason to be skeptical about the extraordinary claims and also about the mundane claims that surround them.
Okay. That's it. There are three points there to potentially respond to, Jim. Take your pick. Maybe, first of all, distance from the event. You can go in and check that palm print in front of you.
Sure.
You don't have these events in front of you, and we don't know exactly how long after the fact some of the Gospels were written down.
Okay, a couple of things about that. I know we're actually short on time here, but my cases are never the day after the event. My cases are decades following the actual event, and I've been able to go back and find pieces of physical evidence on occasion that support an eyewitness testimony. I think we do something very, very similar when we look at archaeological evidence. Now, I can tell you a lot of folks want to reject the depth of archaeological evidence, but remember, archaeological evidence is probably the premier example of touch point evidence. It's what I have not termed it this, but I quote somebody in my book who does. It's a discipline of fractions. Only a fraction of sites have been discovered. Only a fraction of those sites have been excavated. Only a fraction of those sites are even biblical. So we have to look at the fraction approach to archaeology. I think the case we have to support circumstantially the reliability of this issue of corroboration is pretty deep in this sense. It involves not only archaeological confirmations we see. It involves the statements of non-Christians in antiquity, both Jewish and pagan. It involves also the corroboration of internal evidence, as we see in terms of accurate descriptions of government structure, accurate descriptions of locations, accurate use of language, even the accurate use of personal pronouns, proper names, rather, that are used in the region in this time period. So you see there's lots. I mean, so my whole point is here is that what level of corroboration would we expect? I think that for most of us, like you just said a second ago, Leland, the idea here is this includes elements of the supernatural. If I could take all those elements of the supernatural out of the account, and I just presented to you Jesus, the smart guy from the, you know, from 2,000 years ago, you wouldn't have any hesitancy at all at accepting the account as historically reliable, even as corroboration. The problem is that these include superstat. Well, I mean, I wouldn't have. Let's put it that way. I'll just speak personally. My issue with it was I came from a position of philosophical naturalism, and I rejected the existence of anything supernatural. So, in other words, I would have considered those the extraordinary claims you were talking about. I am not suggesting we take the Gospels at their face, but I am suggesting this. We seem to be biased against the Gospels as history for some reason. We say, hey, you can't trust these accounts because they were written by Christians, and Christians are therefore biased. But this is just, I give an example of this in the book. If I see a robbery, and I had a case like this actually occurred, in which somebody came in and did a robbery, and the witness was shocked because she knew this guy from high school, and she could not believe that he'd be the kind of person who'd even commit a robbery. And after it was over, when we interviewed her, she said, I couldn't believe my eyes. Now, the question is, should I trust her at all as a reliable witness? After all, she's convinced that this guy, let's call him Mark Hill, was a robber. He might even say she's a Mark Hillian. But we would say, no, of course not. She's not convinced because she held a pre-existing bias. She's convinced because she watched this guy do a robbery. And the same thing, I think, is happening with the authors of Scripture. They don't begin with this bias toward Jesus. They want to, write him out as this guy he's not. They end up convinced over a period of time on the basis of observation. And that's a very different, I think, situation.
We're going to go to a quick break, and then I'll let you come back again, Leland. So we're talking about the evidence for Christianity, the evidence specifically for the Gospels, and helping us through that is J. Warner Wallace, the author of Cold Case Christianity, bringing the same techniques he uses as a homicide detective to investigate cold cases from decades ago to the issue of whether we can trust the events of the Gospels. We'll let our caller Leland in Canada respond in just a moment's time as we ask this question of whether there's corroborative evidence beyond the Gospels, and the internal evidence of the Gospels as well is what we've moved on to as well. Come back in just a moment's time. I'm Justin Briley. You're listening to the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together, Unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So just to continue and to complete, really, our conversation, let's just hear your response, Leland, to what we were hearing from Jim there. I mean, essentially, he's saying, you talk about bias, maybe you've got a bias as well, in the sense that you're not willing to be open to the supernatural. You think, therefore, that clouds the whole of the testimony of the Gospels, because people who would write that stuff maybe can't be trusted with the historical details as well. Is that fair? I don't know.
That's not actually my point. My point, if I may, I'm sorry to interrupt, is that the existence of the supernatural elements in the book taints or contaminates any, you know, potential veracity of the mundane events. So, sure, I'm sure they got the names of the towns and the names of the people and things like that correct, but the fact that it's all part and parcel of a document or collection of documents that contains a fairly substantial percentage of supernatural elements, it forces, you can't say, well, because there are mundane elements there, the supernatural elements must be true, I guess is the point I'm trying to make.
Right, okay, yeah. Jim, do you want to just respond on that?
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I think that's where I stood for many years. Here's my problem, though, with that. It's the first chapter of the book. Is the first tool you have to have. I can't walk into a crime scene and decide on the basis of the nature of the crime scene. Say it looks to me like it's a domestic violence homicide. Well, you know, I can that's sure it's a possibility, but I cannot elit my preconception. I cannot let that kind of put the guard up or the rails up to limit my investigation. And here's what my problem with this approach is. As a non-believer, I had a presupposition about naturalism that provided me with the definition of what I would accept before I even started. So I already, by definition, excluded anything supernatural. And if the investigation under consideration here is, does something supernatural, God, exist, I can't begin from the position that if it's a supernatural element, it doesn't even belong in the narrative. It's not historical. It's purely mythology. I have started with a decision about the suspect before I even looked at the evidence related to the suspect. So instead, I have to kind of step back and let's just it seems then that the least thing you're going to come to is this, Leland, that the document is reliable about everything it says except for the supernatural. And that's, I think, where a lot of us end up. But then we have to ask ourselves the question, so what is it that's stopping me from taking this step? Is it evidence about the supernatural or a presupposition about the supernatural?
Do you have a presupposition then that's kind of making you weigh the other evidence in the balance?
I don't think I do, but I operate more from a case of I've been on the planet for, 40 years, and I've never seen anything supernatural myself. I've never seen any evidence of any other, verifiable supernatural events happening in my 40 years on the planet. If you go back, there's not a lot of evidence for anything even before I was here. So I'm operating on an assumption of if 99.99999999% of history contains no supernatural, verifiable supernatural events, I'm operating from the preponderance of the evidence, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Okay. Jim.
Well, it's a matter of not preponderance. It's a matter of reasonable, beyond a reasonable doubt. And so what happens here, it seems to me, is that we begin, and I do think in some ways, Leland, if you listen to your words in the last question, you begin with this idea that if a supernatural is there, it cannot be trusted. And I understand that a lot of it is from our personal experience. But it's interesting to me that we take this view related to issues of faith, or issues of Christianity especially, and we say, hey, if I can't believe anything that I can't see with my own eyes. I can't believe anything, for example, I can't discover with science. When in fact, that position you hold is something you can't see with your own eyes and can't discover with science. You're applying a standard to this, which you really don't apply to any other aspect of your life. The vast majority of information you hold in your head is not through experience. The vast majority of information you hold in your head is through the teaching of somebody else who gave it to you. You took it on the authority of somebody. So for me, I want to look at these accounts and say, do I have good reason to believe they are authoritative in some way, or they are reliable in some way? And of course, there are claims, many claims of history that include supernatural elements. You might say, well, they're a small percentage, but it turns out this example, this claim of history that includes supernatural elements seems to have been one of the most significant claims in all of history. It seems to have changed the culture and set our trajectory for 2,000 years. So I think we got to really assess it in terms of its reliability rather than how frequently. Let me tell you, I work cold cases. These kinds of cases don't happen all that often. They are extremely rare in our state. That's why people get away with them for so many years. But the rarity of the case does not preclude me from beginning an investigation. That's just the nature of these kinds of investigations. And it does not preclude me from the existence of a true killer. So I have to kind of look at that one issue with a little bit of skepticism too.
We are going to have to start to draw things to a close. Leland, I'm sure there's much more you'd want to say in response, and the time always beats us with this. But really appreciate you being on the show and being bold enough to come on and do the discussion and everything. So thank you for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
Great to have you, Leland. Hope you enjoy continuing to listen to Unbelievable. Very interesting sort of two very different callers there. I'm sure you'd agree, Jim. But both, of course, coming sort of from the point of view of, can we trust these gospels? I think probably different issues, as we've heard, that have been at the behind all this. The big issue, I suppose, for me is that it seems like, as you bring these issues of comparing it to crime cases and what you would present in the court of law and so on, and ask, what you seem to have said in the course of the program, Jim, is that even though there are discrepancies that a jury may have to take into account, a jury is looking for a kind of a bigger picture of reliability on the part of a witness. And I guess the point is that for many, many atheists who perhaps want every single issue addressed and cleaned up, well, you're never going to get there, because you wouldn't get that in a crime case either. You're going to have to accept that there's going to be some areas where there's a sort of certain area of not quite sure exactly how that pans out, because you're looking at the bigger case that people are ultimately going to make their decision on. Is that making any sense to you?
Yeah, it does. I'll tell you something. I will start blogging on some of these specifics at coldcasechristianity.com so you can kind of see what the traditional Christian response has been. But I think the overarching principle is actually more important than the one you just mentioned, Justin. I just did a case that was on Dateline in March in which a man murdered his wife 30 years ago, got rid of her body, and claimed that she ran off. And we had many unanswered questions. How did he kill her? Where did he kill her? What did he do with her body? How did he move her car to make it look like she was still alive? Could not answer any of those. They remained unanswered questions as the jury came to a 4.5-hour decision about his guilt. And a month later, he confessed to all of it. So I think we have to remember when we start cases like this, there will always be unanswered questions. This does not mean there is an irreconcilable difference or a discrepancy that cannot be reconciled through history. It means that we don't have the means available to us at the point of making a decision to reconcile that difference. And that may often be the case now. As an atheist, I didn't have the way to reconcile, you know, all the beginning of matter from non-matter, all those kinds of issues, the beginning of the universe, yet I was willing to step out in this direction in spite of those unanswered questions. So we all do it. I just think here we have to kind of apply the same courtesy, the same grace to the narrative in Scripture.
It's fascinating stuff. You've been blogging. You do a lot of blogging, actually. You've mentioned already coldcasechristianity.com. is where people can go to find out more. And you're going to be picking up, I know, some of the issues we've raised already in the program there. So do check out the blog if you want to maybe delve a little bit deeper into some of Jim's responses to some of the issues that came up earlier with Rob around the dating of Jesus' birth and how that fits with John and his timeline and so on, and indeed what we've been talking about with Leland. Coldcasechristianity.com. I guess what for me is interesting in the end is this idea of I think there's a term for this, isn't there, which is essentially beyond reasonable doubt. That's what a jury in the end is asked to judge a case on, right?
Absolutely. That's the highest standard we have, Justin, in court. That's the highest standard.
And you'd apply the same principle to assessing the case for Christianity, presumably.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at what we say is important in a criminal case in which we're going to decide the fate of a defendant, is he going to live? Is he going to die? Is he going to spend the rest of his life in jail? We use a standard which is really the highest standard available to us in criminal trials here in America, the reasonable doubt standard, beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not beyond any possible doubt. It's beyond reasonable doubt. And these are the doubts that I think are raised evidentially. And so I think what we do is we say if that standard is good enough for the temporal future of human beings on this planet, whether they live or die or spend the rest of their life in jail, it ought to be a standard that's good enough for us to judge our eternal fate, our eternal lives. And so I think we can use the standard of reasonable doubt when assessing the Gospels as well. And that's the approach at least I took as a skeptic coming in. And when it really came down to it, Justin, it came down to this. I was still rejecting the Scriptures, rejecting what the Bible taught, not on the basis of the evidence available to me, but on the basis of what I wanted the evidence to tell me. It was an issue not so much that was based in rational rejection of evidence, but in volitional rejection of this entire worldview. And so I had to really assess, what is it? Am I starting off with a presuppositional bias that eliminated me from seeing the proper suspect in this case or the proper conclusion of this investigation? And I think once I realized that it was really more me determining my view of the evidence than it was the evidence determining the view of the evidence, it was time to make a change.
Well, it's been a fascinating show and really interesting to hear your personal story alongside it as well. Jim, thank you very much for joining us on the program today. If you want to find out more about the book, well, a good place to start is, of course, as I mentioned, Jim's website there, coldcasechristianity.com. It is really fascinating. I've really enjoyed reading it just because not only do you get, obviously, a good grounding in the case for the Gospels, you also just find out all kinds of fascinating things about homicide detective work as well along the way. So highly recommended by me and many others as well. It's certainly been making quite a lot of interest in apologetic circles and hopefully beyond as well. Jim Warner-Wallace, thank you very much for being with me today.
Thank you so much, Joseph, for having me. It was quite an honor and a privilege.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed that discussion. Please let us know what you thought. Email us at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or leave a comment on our Twitter account at unbelievablefe or on the Premier Unbelievable Facebook page. And do check out our website, premierunbelievable.com. That's premierunbelievable.com. Thank you for listening, and see you next week for another Unbelievable Classic Replay.